Welcome to the Spanish Arpada. I'm Sarah.
And I am Peter.
And we are ranking and reviewing all of the rulers of Spain from Leovigild to Felipe VI. And this time we are going to be talking about Mohammed I of Cordoba.
I'm guessing we're in the south.
We are indeed in the south. So this is King Mohammed of the Emirate of Cordoba, right. Which is Al-Andalus, the south of Spain.
Right.
Yeah, so we just finished two kings in the north, which were Ramiro and Ordoño.
Yes.
And now we're backing up slightly to get Mohammed, who was the king in the south for much of, well, for all of both of their reigns, and actually for much of the next king's reign. But the next king is Alfonso III, and I want to, you know, that's going to be a lot.
I was going to say, that's a big one.
That's a big one. The Chronicle is indeed named after him. So
yeah, we've been listening to that Chronicle. It's all been prelude up until now.
Well, actually, I was going to mention this when we jumped into the Chronicle, but we are actually pretty much done with the Chronicle of Alfonso III.
Okay.
It stops before Alfonso III.
What?
Bit of a tease. Well, it's even worse because it probably wasn't even written in Alfonso III's time. It was probably written in Ordoño's time anyway.
Well,
but
so then there's no excuse not
there's
to
There's no excuse.
Him.
But the last line of the Chronicle of Alfonso III is, in the year 866, with Ordoño dead, his son Alfonso succeeded him as king.
Oh, Lord.
That is the only time Alfonso III is named in the Chronicle of Alfonso III.
This is the most disappointing prequel since The Phantom Menace.
I know. Right. It's so bad. But anyway, right. But we're talking about Mohammed.
Okay.
Yes. Right. So Mohammed I, he is the first king of Al-Andalus with that name. Obviously not the first person named Mohammed. But as we have discovered in this...
pretty thick on the ground, I would imagine.
Yes, as we have discovered in this series, Muhammad is a very common name in the Islamic world, much like Jesus is common in Spanish-speaking countries, Maria, etc.
It's a lot to put on a kid.
It is, especially poor Muhammad the Saracen. Muhammad the Saracen. Well, this Muhammad had a little bit of a better pedigree than whoever the heck Muhammad the Saracen was, because
he probably not nearly as exciting a career, but we'll find out.
But he was the son of Abd al-Rahman II, from our last episode.
Yes.
And his mother, we do have the name of his mother. So his mother was named Kataz. K-A-H-T-A-Z, Kataz. There's no indication that she was from an important family, could have just been a concubine, could have been the daughter or sister of a minister. We don't know.
Okay.
But we do have her name, so that's, you know, something.
I was going to say, that's an improvement given how we've been with most of the mothers of these people.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Muhammad was born in the year 822.
All right.
Probably in the month of May. And he, as most of his siblings and cousins and everybody else in the royal family, grew up in Cordoba.
Right.
Right. So he grew up in court. He knew that he was going to be important in the court. Mm-hmm. And towards the end of his father's life, he knew that he was going to be the emir, the king.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
There is a legend that there was a eunuch that served in the court who was a Christian and who was intriguing so that one of Muhammad's brothers would become king.
Right. You never hear stories of a eunuch in court who turned out to be a really nice guy.
Well, the reason that I say this with the tone of skepticism and hesitancy in my voice that you hear is because one of the defining themes of Muhammad's kingship is trouble with the Christians.
Oh, well, there's a shock.
And a lot of people say, well, the reason that Muhammad had such trouble with the Christians is because he had held a grudge against this Christian eunuch that didn't want him to become king.
You know, having a grudge against the Christians does not require any kind of childhood, you know, shenanigans. You can just pay attention to what they do when they're, you know, when you're an adult.
Like, the story sounds very made up to me. And
yes, it sounds
like very much like a Just So story. So I'm gonna say probably there was no eunuch that tried to keep him from becoming king that also happened to be a Christian.
Yeah, historical shenanigans are called on that one.
Yes.
Okay.
However, it is true that he had a lot of trouble with the Christian population at Al-Andalus. So let's kind of back up a little bit and talk about that, because it's been a hot minute since Abd al-Rahman II.
Yes, indeed.
So we discussed in his episode about the Christian martyrs syndrome that was going around Cordoba at the time. You remember this?
Oh, that was the saddest thing ever. When the church has to get involved saying, you guys are taking Christianity too far, that's bad.
So a couple things fed into this. First of all, I didn't mention it in this episode, but we're going to talk about it a little bit more because he comes up in the story. The church leadership, the person in church leadership who was most pushing this martyrdom, you know, thing.
Not by example, apparently.
But his name was Eulogius. And okay. We've met him before.
Yeah, that's
Eulogius. Eulogius was the monk who took the little trip to all the monasteries up in the Basque country that were founded by Iñigo Arista and copied all of the lost knowledge and brought it back to Cordoba.
Okay, we liked him back in that story.
Yes, well, it's a really cool story.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm a fan anymore.
Well, it led to a renaissance of the Christian literary community because of all these different works. But, that also kind of feeds into a resurgence of the community as a whole, including martyr stories.
Yeah, I was going to say, if your life's project leads you to heading up a death cult, maybe you should have chosen a different path.
Right. So this is the other side of the coin of the library story that I told you in Iñigo Arista's episode. Right. So that's the same Eulogius. So he's the one heading up the whole martyrdom push, telling all these stories in church about martyrs and how great they are and how great it is to be martyred for the cause.
Right. As you know, one of my parents is a librarian, and I will say this scans.
Right. So that's the first thing. Unfortunately, being a Christian in Cordoba under Muslim rule is not bad. You're not being fed to lions, is what I'm saying.
You're people of the book.
You can listen to Pontifax and listen to all those early episodes and hear all the horrible, terrible tortures that Christians went through.
Exactly.
This isn't that. Mm-hmm. This is just, you can't profess your faith in public.
Yes.
You can't convert anybody. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But that's it.
And that's it.
And that's pretty much it.
Yeah. So this is not, that's not oppression. Trust me.
Well, what it leads to is people becoming martyrs by marching up to the nearest imam they can see and proclaiming loudly that they believe in Jesus Christ and they think that the prophet Muhammad is a fake.
Oh, God.
Because that's the only way really to do it.
These people are vegans too, aren't they?
Now, in their defense, I will say it is not bad to be a Christian in Cordoba, but it's also not good to be a Christian in Cordoba. And this actually also extends to the Muwallad population. Now, the Muwallads, remember, are former Christians who converted to Islam.
Right.
And the Muwallads were actually angrier than the Christians about their place in society.
Right. Of course they are.
They kind of felt like, well, we converted, so now we should be full members of Muslim society. And it did not work out that way.
Right. You literally pitched us on this religion by saying that all who join are equal.
Are equal, exactly.
And I believe what you said as soon as I converted was, yoink. So
basically, a lot of Muwallads realized that they may be Muslims, but that doesn't mean that they're going to have the same amount of societal trust as people who have been Muslims all their life, people who are not native Spaniards, et cetera, et cetera. Right. All those pesky little human xenophobic influences or impulses still exist.
Yep.
Right. Because these are just regular people, just like
us. Humans going to bigot. That's just going to happen.
And then, and we talked about this a little bit in Ordoño's episode, but then there was the rebellion in Toledo.
Right.
Right. Okay. So in Toledo, a group of Christians and Muwallads rebelled against the Emir Muhammad. And the reason we talked about it in Ordoño's episode is that Ordoño thought it would be a good idea to support the rebels.
That was
this
sharp.
Is a big turning point in Al-Andalus Asturian relations. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've been at war. They've done intramural warfare every year forever and ever, right? Of course. But this is the first time that one of them has actively tried to interfere in the internal affairs of the other.
Yeah, this is a regime change. This is a new level of
And of course, it didn't work out for the the Toledan rebels are the ones that suffered the most here, right? Muhammad and Ordoño ended up just totally fine with this.
Yes,
but Al-Makari says, quote, "In the meanwhile, the rebels of Toledo, having sought and obtained the assistance of the kings of Galicia and Biscay, Muhammad went out in person against them, and having met them near the Guadalacete, made them fall into an ambush which he had prepared, and slew 20,000 Toledans and 20,000 infidels."
Boy, those equal numbers.
Equal numbers, but it's interesting that they point out 20,000 infidels, which I assume are Christians. So the 20,000 Toledans, they were probably Muwalats.
Yeah. All right.
They were their own people.
So they're down 40,000. That's bad.
Yes.
All right.
So Toledo is squashed. That rebellion is squashed. But it really changes the view of people in the government towards their Christian minority population and towards their Muwalat population.
Yeah, it does.
So this is the first time that we're going to see, first time, I think, since the Visigoths, that we are going to see governmental restrictions and bigoted policies against a minority religion.
Well,
with the Visigoths, it was the Jews.
I was going to say, at least it's not the Jews.
Well, yes.
Okay. All right.
So
I'm sure this being the history of Spain will never again return to that being a problem.
Oh, no. We're never going to see bigotry against minority religions ever again.
Phew.
This is going to be a common theme. So the first restriction is no new church buildings. You cannot build any more churches. And if you have a church that needs renovations, too bad.
Oh, wow. All right.
And you cannot build any more monasteries because that's considered a church.
Well, fair is fair. I mean,
You can't Christian religious buildings whatsoever.
All right. The Christians are out there saying, how about a tent?
Nope, nothing. You are not allowed. Yes. The second is a restriction, an almost complete restriction on Christians serving in the government, and a tightening of restrictions on Muwalats.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Huh. Right.
Yeah.
Again, there are some legends that say this is because he didn't like Christians because of that eunuch, but it's clearly because of the background of Christian Muslim relations in Cordoba at this time.
This is more like I mean to be fair, I did just kill 40,000 of you. There might be a little temptation for payback.
And the third thing that he does is that Eulogius wants to be the Archbishop of Toledo, and Muhammad says no you cannot.
Boy, talk about sending that one back to the bottom of the pile. Do not
reapply. It seems obvious, but again, this is the first time that a Muslim ruler has interfered in the affairs of Christians in Cordoba.
Right.
Normally, they just say, I mean, appoint whoever you want. Who cares? Right. It's not my church.
Exactly.
Deal with yourself.
Do whatever, but no. Okay.
All right. So this is the first time that the king of Al-Andalus is meddling, not in the appointment of judges or imams or anything, but in the appointment of Christian officials.
Right. Okay.
Specifically because he said, no, Eulogius, no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Eulogius dies not long after this and is hailed as a martyr. And then there's a whole...
there's a shock.
Yes. Well, there's a whole to and fro of getting his bones up to Asturias because they want it as relics, and then, you know, that's a whole thing. But so that's Eulogius.
All right. Okay.
Right. So another consequence of this, and I think I mentioned this in Ordoño's episode, is there are a lot of Christians and a lot of Muwalads who are interested in going back to Christianity who go to Asturias. Right.
Okay.
There's a huge influx this cultural influence in Asturias now. And this in the north, I think I mentioned this when we introduced this and talked about different names. We talk about Mozarabic, Mozarabic, Mozarabic.
Okay.
And this refers to people who had been living in Al-Andalus, are now living in Christian territories, but they have the cultures and traditions of the south.
Okay. All right. Yes. 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 And they are, and all right. And these are these Mualads who have now gone back to Christianity, or are they?
They're mostly Christians.
Okay.
Because, for example, we talk a lot about the Mozarabic rite in the Catholic Church. It's very distinct from the Asturian or Visigothic rite. Even though they both came from the same place, they've been separated for so many years. Mm. The influences, those Southern influences, have gone into the church liturgy. And so there's a lot of church discussions about how to integrate the two.
Oh, I would imagine that rite is mostly based around, well, look who's come crawling back.
I mean, it wasn't their fault. You know, they probably lived in the South their whole lives and then got conquered, you know.
Well, but just saying.
Yes. Yeah. It's actually a very interesting linguistic topic to look at the Mozarabic rite and compare it to the Latin rite and see how languages have diverged.
It's super cool. Yeah.
So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, Mozarabic, that language, those language uses, and comparing them to what things were in the North.
Right.
Fascinating linguistics topic.
Yes.
Anyway, so this is the big thing that Muhammad is remembered for, is fights with the Christians. Oppression of the Christians and oppression of the Mualads.
All right.
As a matter of fact, there are several uprisings during Muhammad's reign, and pretty much all of them are headed by Mualads.
Well, as they should be, to be fair.
So most of the uprisings, and it gets more and more rocky as we get to the end of his reign. Mm-hmm. It's mostly all Mualads.
Okay. All right.
The biggest one that I'm going to mention here, because it's really the only one that's most important, is the destruction of Merida.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. So this is in the year 867, end of the year, like December. So 867, 868. In this year, the city of Merida was completely destroyed and deserted by its inhabitants.
Holy hell. What? Okay. Yeah.
So I'll read from Al-Bakari. He says, the cause of its destruction was the repeated insurrections of which the inhabitants had been guilty during the reign of this sultan, as well as that of his father and predecessor. So we've seen Merida as a hotbed for insurrection for a while. It was always a Visigoth stronghold. You know, there's a lot of church history in Merida. And basically what happens is that there is an uprising led by the Mualads of the city, and it was repressed so brutally. The walls were torn down, and the city is basically left empty.
Whoa.
To this day, I mean, Merida is still there, and it's still a city of decent size in the area. It's the capital of its province.
Right.
But in Extremadura, the biggest and most important city is now Badajoz.
All right.
Yeah, it's so not Merida anymore.
It never fully recovers.
Fully recovers.
Okay.
It's never going to become the important city that it was before.
All right.
Al-Makari also points this out. He says, this is so funny. He says, a certain writer pretends to have heard in the East the following verses predicting the fate of Merida many years before that wealthy city was destroyed.
Oh my God, we're throwing shade at a different chronicle. Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
And here are the verses. Woe to Merida, the rebellious city which rears its presumptuous head against the lords of the age. Though its inhabitants now enjoy every luxury and comfort, it will soon be dreary as a desert. Woe to Merida, the day that the sultan shall appear with his forces before her walls.
Not exactly top 40 material.
Only that, I think Al-Bakari points out quite rightly, this is not a very good prophecy. It could be any time in Merida's history.
Yeah. I was gonna say,
it's kind of exactly what has happened to Merida many times. The only difference is now that it has been completely destroyed.
Yeah, it's sort of like predicting, you know, traffic and nice weather in LA. Well,
yes,
you're correct, but
yes. So that's Muhammad and the Christians and the Mualads. Of course, there's also foreign affairs that Muhammad I has to deal with. We talked about one of these foreign affairs in Ordoño's episode because it was the invasion that he did along with Musa ibn Musa of the Banu Qasi into the eastern part of Asturias. Now, actually, interestingly enough, the chronicles seem to match up here.
Oh, like, really?
They actually seem to agree with each other. I don't remember if I mentioned this during Ramiro and Ordoño's episode, but Al-Makari says the first act of his reign was to send forth an army under the command of Musa ibn Musa, governor of Dudela, which ravaged the territory of Alava and the castles and took some fortresses. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
Very straightforward.
Yep,
the
got that.
Chronicle of Alfonso III says he, meaning Ordoño, did battle with the Chaldeans frequently and always emerged the victor. At the outset of his reign, the province of the Basques rebelled against him. When he and his army invaded, the Saracen host suddenly advanced against him from the other side. But with God's help, he put the Chaldeans to flight and brought the Basques under his jurisdiction. Again, right. Very simple. So both of these seem to really coincide in a way that we don't normally get. They both say, yes, we fought each other. This was the time it happened. There were a lot of casualties, and that was the end.
Right.
And that is what it is. You know, usually one will say it and the other won't because it was too embarrassing, or one will super exaggerate and the other will be like, oh, well, it was fine. But we really do have a concordance, an agreement of how that first one went.
That's helpful. They're all able to sort of throw shade on Musa ibn Musa, though. I noticed basically they sort of are able to blame the Basques.
Yes.
So maybe that sort of accounts for the fact that both sides are telling the same story. But maybe not.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting that you mentioned the hatred of Musa ibn Musa, because at this point he's changed his coat so many times.
He can't pick a side.
Yeah. During Muhammad's reign, only at the very beginning and the very end are the Banu Qasi important. They're important at the beginning because of Musa ibn Musa, because of this battle where Musa ibn Musa is pretty much dispatched, right?
Yes.
Comes back badly under the aegis of Cordoba, and the Basques become attached to Asturias, right?
Correct.
Then there's a long period where the Banu Qasi just kind of stay at home.
Head down.
Like 20 years of nothing. Yep. And then at the end of Muhammad's reign, we have another resurgence of the Banu Qasi, where Musa ibn Musa's son takes up the mantle again, is now old enough and experienced enough to take up the mantle and attempt another rebellion, which is also not successful. Let me just skip to the end and tell you that. Shorten that story up a little bit. So
the history of the Basques is we never win and it doesn't matter.
The Arabic chronicles also mentioned that second fight between Ordoño and Muhammad, which was over Pamplona. Once again, I'm citing from Al-Makari, but he says that Muhammad caused an invasion to be made into the territory of Pamplona.
That is some real interesting semi-passive language.
I pointed out in Ordoño's episode that Muhammad probably allowed the Vikings
into
his territory. So this is when Garcia Iñiguez, so the son of Iñigo Garcia, this is when Garcia was king of the Basques. He was allied with Ordoño, as I mentioned, and they really kind of took it on the chin from the Vikings. Then they came back and they brought Garcia's son Fortun, who was prisoner in Cordoba for 20 years.
Still, if you have to be someplace for 20 years, Cordoba's not a bad
place. It's not bad.
Yeah.
As we go on through the sources and we look at these intramural sports, basically fighting, we see more and more as we go on into later into Muhammad's reign, we see that he starts sending his son. This son is a man named Al-Mundir, and he's going to be he's going to be king next.
All right.
So, in 865, Muhammad dispatched his son to Alava and the castles, which he wasted. In the same year, Muhammad led an army against the inhabitants of Galicia. And then he sends his son to Pamplona. There's Al-Mundir again in 876. So we see that he delegates to, he sets up this person as his son, as his heir.
These are, Galicia and Pamplona, these are presumably plundering as opposed to conquering?
Not a conquer. Usually the invasion will be followed by the phrase, he wasted the territory, or that which right. he wasted, right? So it's just mm-hmm. like, you know, slash and burn, take all the good stuff and run away.
Right. I mean, yes. and we had mentioned in the last episode that Ordonio had been working on repopulating certain areas, Leon and that sort of thing. And I just wondered if maybe this was pushing back against that.
That's actually a really good insight. Yes, mm-hmm. because a lot of these Christians and Muwallads who left Al-Andalus mm-hmm.
right.
eventually settled in this dispopulated area, which
right.
you know,
okay.
Ordonio was really pushing to settle.
Just so yes. yeah, okay, mm-hmm. okay, cool.
Yep. So, right. So Muhammad was king mm-hmm. for 35 years.
Whoa,
which is a decent amount.
That so is a hell of an amount. Yeah,
he was born in 822. He took the throne in 852.
Uh huh.
And he died in 886.
Wow. Okay.
Yep.
I mean, that's nearly three 12-year-old scotches that you would live to see bottled and decanted. That is impressive.
Indeed it is, I suppose.
That's how I measure time.
Okay. Well, yes. He was succeeded by his son, Al-Mundir ibn Muhammad.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Okay, good.
And the succession was more or less peaceful. No, nothing big to report. There's squabbling among brothers, but right. we'll get to that.
You know, the more or less just makes my stomach sink.
We'll get to that in the next episode.
Oh, goody.
But in general, that was the life and reign of Muhammad I of Al-Andalus. Right.
Not uneventful by any
not
means.
Not uneventful.
35
yeah.
years. Good Lord. Okay.
35 years. Yep. All you right. want to rate him?
Sure do.
The first category is conquistadores. How good was he at battle? How much land did he conquer? Was he any good at war? He doesn't seem to be remarkably good or bad at war.
No, I mean, my sense of it is, you know, I'm inclined to. He comes across as a pretty solid B student. That is to say, he puts men in the field. He accomplishes what he sets out to do, but he's not somebody who ever tries to hit it out of a park. He strikes me as a guy who is very comfortable hitting singles, as it were.
Yeah, he didn't gain any territory.
No.
Right? So we can't say that. But no. I will say he was very good at putting down revolts.
Right.
He did two huge ones, Toledo mm-hmm. and Merida, and yes. several smaller ones as well.
Right. And given what happened to Merida, I mean,
yeah.
you know. And it sounds like he's successful going up against Galicia and Pamplona. Again, nothing...
there's nothing huge to report, you're like, right. okay, he's decent at war.
Right. But
he's
but
not Abdalrahman the first.
Right.
You know, he's not Musa.
Right. The category is not plunderer, it's conquistador, and there
Indeed.
Isn't a lot of conquista going on. So
there is not. Yeah. But I want to give him a couple points just for sending off those rebellions.
Yeah,
so,
no, I will.
Amazingly yes. effectively.
Right. Very, very, very true. I'm feeling a 4 seems high, but a 3 seems low.
Well, I was going to go 4. So if
oh,
you wanted
okay.
to go 3.
Yeah, why don't we do that?
Then we could split
feels,
the difference.
That feels about
yeah,
right.
I don't think it's quite mid-tier.
No,
it's definitely
no.
not above 5.
No, no, God, no. But there,
but
I mean,
it's
there
better
are no,
than
there,
like a 2.
There are no big swings, but as a result, there are no misses either.
Yeah.
Yeah, but definitely someone who played it safe, and we don't reward playing it safe.
Right.
So yeah.
Well, for conquistadores, that is a 4 from me and a 3 mm-hmm. from you. That is 7
yes.
points.
Mm-hmm.
Our next category is
yes.
no me digas. So let's talk a little bit about Muhammad's personality
oh.
And what he was like in his personal life,
oh,
whether
goody.
He was scandalous at all.
All right.
I'm reading from the Akbar Mahmuha now.
Oh, all right.
About Muhammad. The Emir Muhammad ibn al-Rahman, Abd al-Rahman, was mild-mannered and chaste, slow to anger, and courteous.
Oh,
he was versed in he was versed in literature and good at arithmetic.
Oh my God, he was good at math.
It is said of him that he handled the accounts of his civil servants and personally monitored their affairs due to his expertise in mathematics, the soundness of his natural ability, and his facility in knowledge and literature. He checked them for faults and mistakes in their work.
Oh my God, he's Calvin Coolidge, Jimmy Carter.
He looked over their spreadsheets.
Oh, this is so tiresome.
So he really liked adding and subtracting to the point that he would pull the paperwork from his accountants and look it over to make sure they didn't make any mistakes.
Oh, God.
The Akbar Makhmuha goes on to tell actually what I think is a really funny story to illustrate his patience.
Okay.
And what a patient and mild-mannered person he was. It begins an impressive example of his patience and resolve. So here we go. So basically, this story is about a minister of his named Hisham.
Okay.
Hashim ibn Abdulaziz.
Okay.
So Hashim had beef with someone else in the court. Mm-hmm. This other person is never named. He had beef with someone in the court, and he really wanted the emir to dismiss this guy because he hated this other guy.
Okay.
So he complained to Muhammad about it. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what do you think of this guy, Emir? Don't you think he's terrible? Don't you think that he should be dismissed from his post? Uh-huh. And the Emir didn't disapprove of the man. He didn't really care. He was like, that guy's, I don't really care. That guy's fine. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Hashim says, all right, I gotta up my game. So he goes to as many people as he can get support from. And he says, I need you to write a letter to the Emir talking about how awful this guy is. And if there's enough letters, then maybe he'll get dismissed, right? So he goes and he cajoles and he harasses and he threatens as many people as he can to writing nasty letters about
whisper
this.
Whisper campaign.
Yes.
All right.
And then he goes back to the Emir with a letter of his own. He says, I've written this letter about this guy. It's so terrible. And the Emir reads it and he says, oh, those are very serious accusations. Are you the only one that feels this way? And Hashim says, well, let's go check the post box, shall we?
Oh, I don't know.
So they go to where, I guess a suggestion box. It's not really clear. Yeah. It says, go to the recess in the audience hall and bring the bundle of letters there. So apparently there's a place where people can just put like complaints.
By the way, if Muhammad doesn't strike you as the guy who had a suggestion box installed, you haven't been paying attention to this episode.
He might have installed the suggestion box.
Of course he did.
So Muhammad says, all right, Hashim, go get the suggestion box and I want you to read, I want you to read the letters that are in there, right? Uh-huh. Yeah. I'll pick it up with what the Akbar Makhmuha says. So go and bring the bundle of letters there. There were about 100. Then Muhammad said, read them. All the letters demanded Hashim's death.
Whoa!
Hashim began to read, and as he did this, his hand shook, his brow began to sweat, and his face became agitated. When he finished each one, the Emir told him to read another one until he had finished them all. So I don't know what's funnier to me, the idea that all these people that Hashim harassed instead wrote letters about how Hashim had harassed them, or whether the Emir himself had planted these letters. I don't know which is funnier. But clearly this did not turn out the way Hashim wanted.
No, that's a bucket full of banana peels.
When he finishes, Muhammad says, Hashim, what is your excuse? And Hashim, of course, throws himself at the Emir's feet and begs forgiveness and says, all these people are out to get him and they all hate him. And isn't it just so terrible? And cries and cries and cries. And Muhammad says, all right, go away and don't do this again. So this is an example of how patient and tolerant the guy is.
I mean, okay, it's a good story, but
it is a pretty good story. Apparently he was very well educated. He loved science. He would bring scientists to the court who the imams would be like, oh, this is dangerous knowledge, and Muhammad would say, I'd like to hear it, why don't you tell me.
Yeah.
So he just really liked learning, and he liked math, and he liked spreadsheets, and he liked playing tricks on nasty people.
Wow. Well, the third detail, I mean, the last detail that you threw in there makes me like him a bit more, but...
It's definitely interesting, but is it scandalous? I mean, I would tell people about it, especially if I was there to see the guy's face turn redder and redder with each letter that he pulled out of the bag.
Absolutely.
Also, the idea that he included a suggestion box.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that says something about his character.
It does. I don't know, though. I mean, he's lost so many points for the spreadsheets.
He has.
I will go with two.
I was like, I'm going to give him a two.
I'll give him a two. Yeah.
Because I talk about him.
Yeah, I was going to say he's definitely gossip worthy, but he's not scandalous. That's an anecdote. It's not
like
the same
if you
thing.
Told me that. Like the king liked to do spreadsheets in his spare time.
Yeah.
I would go, huh, that's interesting. I wouldn't go, no way. Right.
No,
and that's
no,
what
exactly.
Nobody Digas means.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
So two
for me as well. So that is a four for Nome Digas. Sorry, mm-hmm. Muhammad, you are too nerdy.
Well, no, way too nerdy.
Our third category is Orthodoxia. How much did he advance the faith, and what did he do for his own religion? Well,
we now raise that most difficult of questions. You know, is religious oppression in the name of your own faith a thing that gets you points in this category?
I'm trying to remember what we did for the Visigoths, that's the last time that we've really had some serious oppression.
Exactly. I think we have to give him points, but not too many. Either that or we have to go back and give him more Nome Digas story, because we did sort of blip over the...
All right. Well, we can give it here, I suppose.
We can. I mean, Christians forbidden from building. You know how I feel about building.
Yes.
If I'm gonna want mosques, I also want cathedrals. That is definitely and
more architecture. We are pro architecture on this.
Exactly.
Podcast.
We are very pro architecture. I'm not crazy about it. And I will also say I think that allowing the Mualads to be ostracized, oppressed, mm-hmm. excluded, that is crap Islam.
It's not very in line with the tenets of your religion.
That is expressly not what you were supposed to do.
Right.
I think that in a certain respect, what we're looking at is someone who allowed, nationalist bigotry, not outright racial bigotry, mm-hmm. To override what is, let's face it, one of the most admirable qualities of his religion. That kind of sucks. It's clear that, you know, he comes across clearly as somebody who believes in his faith, but he doesn't believe in it in a way that reflects the values of that faith.
I'm just gonna throw it out there.
Yeah.
Which of our rulers so far, Christian or Muslim, have?
Well,
Hisham,
you know,
maybe I
was gonna say yes.
Hisham wouldn't have didn't cross that bridge because
yep,
he didn't
cross that bridge. Yes, absolutely. I think Alfonso the Second.
Oh, very true. Alfonso the Second.
I mean, didn't we give him a 10?
We gave him quite a lot. That is true.
I mean, we've had a few, is my point. I just feel as though and maybe this is just me looking ahead. I mean, I'm going to come down so hard on some of the future Christian kings for being vile hypocrites.
Right.
I feel as though I must, in good conscience, apply that to non-Christian religious leaders.
Yes.
I suppose if you want to flip it around, you can say, okay, by oppressing Christianity, he lowered its influence and therefore increased the influence of Islam. On the other hand, though...
Well, I mean, he also gave Asturias a shot in the arm.
Right.
With all that new population.
Right, right. For sure. I mean, this is complicated.
It's very complicated.
I wish I could just drop on him.
I'm going to say three.
I'm going to say three. That was exactly what I was going to say. I'm going to say three. And really, it would have been higher, except for the you can't build cathedrals part.
Right. Because it's not like he was uninvolved in religious matters.
No,
so
that's true.
I feel like I can't give him a zero.
No, definitely not a zero.
But I don't think what he did necessarily helped Islam as a religion.
Right, right. Although he did... as I recall, didn't he work with the church leaders on shutting
down
the
martyrdom? He did, to try to cut down on the martyrdom, and he kept Eulogius from becoming Bishop of Toledo.
There's an awareness of, you know, I mean, again, I think this is why you definitely can't give him a zero. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think three feels...
I think three is good.
Three feels like I can walk away with my head held high. Yeah, okay, we'll say three.
All right, well, that is a six for Orthodoxia.
You're not knocking this out of the park.
Not really. Our fourth category is El Resto. What are the other things he did that went along with being king?
All right.
Well, he ruled for 35 years.
35 years. Nothing to sneeze
pretty
at.
Pretty good.
Yep.
We don't have a lot of information about his family. I mean, Abd al-Rahman II and al-Hakam and all of their billions and billions of kids. We don't have that for Abbas.
I was going to say, we know he has one son.
We know that he has at least a couple because, as I said, there's some squabbling among brothers after this.
But he
does have at least one son, which is al-Mundir, who becomes king after him.
Okay, that's good. That's a thing.
There isn't really any information about his death. The Akbar Mahmuha just says he died in August of 886 at the age of 67.
Yeah, okay, well.
So he just died.
Nothing sinister
so
about
not
that.
An interesting death or anything like that.
No room of knives and poison, no nothing there. Okay, all right.
Two interesting things that I have, two little facts for this.
Yes.
Number one is that he engaged in diplomacy with Charles the Bald.
Oh,
King
all right.
Franks. Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing really necessarily came of it, but it's the first reference I've seen to them talking to each other outside of war.
That's something.
Like, I don't know that the Franks and Al-Andalus have chatted if it hasn't been about war.
Right.
But apparently Muhammad I sent him camels in 865.
I mean, you know what? That is a hell of a gift to somebody north of the Pyrenees.
Yeah, I'm sure they were pretty cool.
Right. That is, yeah, you take that stuff up north towards Paris, people are going to lose their minds.
Yeah. And the second interesting thing that I have is we have a coin. It's been so long since we've had a coin.
Yes.
Because basically all of the mints have been, I mean, they've basically just still been using coins from the East that come in through trade.
Right.
And in the north, there aren't any mints at this time anyway. Okay. So we haven't seen a coin. So this is a coin that was minted in Al-Andalus. It has Muhammad's name on it. So that's what I have for El Resto. What do we want to give him? He definitely has the trappings of kingship.
Yes. I mean,
the camels is pretty cool.
The camels is very cool.
And 35 years is nothing to sneeze at.
Right. No, 35 years is actually pretty impressive. Son and heir, a transition that went more or less smoothly, destroyed a city. The world reflected his presence in it. Again, two feels low, three feels high. What are you thinking?
I'm going to give him a nice solid five.
Oh,
I think
wow.
He did okay.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go. I'm trying to.
You can still say two or three.
I will say three. Three.
I don't mind if we don't coincide.
Right. Yeah. No.
I
no.
Just
no.
Think
no.
That
that's
he was eminently okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Okay. All yep. right. Well, I will say three then.
So a five and a three, that is an eight.
Maybe a few more Vikings and camels and I would have gone higher.
Well, there were Vikings, but
I know. I said a few more. Just okay. All right.
That is a total score of 25.
Not great.
Not great. But we do still have one more question. Do we let Mohammed I side the fuero, the charter of rights that a king would side with his subjects in medieval Spain? Or do we tell him fuera, get out?
Well, I think we tell him fuera. We don't tell him that.
I think we have to tell him
fuera. I don't think we tell him that vociferously, but as you say, 35 years of okay does not get you fuero.
It doesn't.
It gets you what he really deserves as the person that he was, a nice retirement party and a handshake.
Yeah.
That's basically what he gets.
That is basically what he deserves and got. So, you know, it's he was eh.
Yeah, he was
so,
eh.
Good for you. Exactly. This is our first Southern king in a while that has not gotten fuera.
Yeah, I also feel as though we've been very, very generous with it of late. And this is one where I basically say, you know what? No, you know, you don't. He doesn't match up with those other guys. I feel better about those other fueros giving this guy a fuera.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning of the Arab series that we were going to see how if things were going well in the north, they would not be doing so well in the south, and vice versa. When things kind of go dip in the south, then things get better in the north. We are coming off on a time where Alfonso III is going to be king, and things are going to go really, really well for Asturias.
Oh, all right.
Excellent. And part of the reason why it does is because things are about to go not so great for Al-Andalus.
All right.
There's going to be a bunch of difficult years for Cordoba coming up, Mohammed is kind of the harbinger of that, unfortunately.
I see. All right.
Yep. Cool. But that is our ranking and review of Mohammed I. Let us know what you think. We are on all social media and have an email. It's all Spanish Arpada. And we like to hear from fans.
We do.
Yep. All right. It is recommendations time.
Yes. Shall I go first?
Go ahead and go first.
All right. I am, this is a recommendation that is coming in, kind of late on the subject matter. As you know, last year, Scorsese put out The Irishman. It was the 3-hour movie featuring De Niro and Pacino and Joe Pesci, premiered, I think, on Netflix. Here's what I will say about that. I am listening to the book upon which the movie is based, and the book is terrific. People found the movie sort of a mixed bag.
Right.
I will say that if you found the movie a mixed bag, but you are interested in the subject matter, I strongly recommend the book, and I strongly recommend the audio version of the book. The book was originally titled "I Heard You Paint Houses."
Okay.
Basically, that expression refers to when a hitman shoots someone, the blood paints the walls.
Okay.
So I heard you paint houses is a way of, I understand you're a contract killer.
Mm-hmm.
It is the story of a man, Frank Sheeran, who largely as a result of a traumatic experience in World War II, got into the hitman game fairly early and quickly became a favorite of Jimmy Hoffa. And so it is very much the story of Jimmy Hoffa, how Jimmy Hoffa rose to power, how he maintained that power with the help and then with the opposition of the mob. If you are at all interested in that kind of story, the sort of, you know, Goodfellas / wise guy type of genre, this one is excellent. And the audio reader is a gentleman by the name of Scott Brick, who I went to college with.
Oh, cool.
Yes, he was one of the stars at the UCLA theater department, and he is now a pretty successful audiobook reader, and he does a terrific job. So it is just a very gripping read, very well written, very well read. I am walking my dog extra long walks these days because I don't want to come back home and stop listening to it.
That's nice.
So it is currently being marketed under the title The Irishman. To tie in with the movie. So if you look for it on audio, you will find it under The Irishman. The author is Charles Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T, and I recommend it. So there you go.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, my recommendation is super nerdy, but it's about web browsers. So,
okay.
I mean, all right. I have been struggling with the Firefox Google Chrome decision for a long time because I think overall Firefox is a better browser, but Google Chrome does the one thing that I need it to do quite often, and that is translate pages.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
And Firefox did not do that until now. Firefox, my recommendation is to start using Firefox again because it has the ability to translate web pages. Now, it is in beta.
Okay.
And what this means is that there are not very many languages. So you can translate things that are in French and German and Italian and Portuguese and Spanish. Also, Polish, Dutch, and Bulgarian for some reason.
I'm waiting for you to say Finnish.
Saying Finnish. That's the first one I checked.
Damn.
I checked it and made a sad face and
went,
and that's the one I need it for the most. However, if you are a fan of this podcast and you look up things that we mentioned in this podcast and the webpage happens to be in Spanish, for example, you can now use Firefox to find out what that page is saying without having to copy and paste into Google Translate.
Nice.
So they are still developing this. They are still hooking it up to different languages, and the languages will expand. But this is the first time I can wholeheartedly recommend Firefox browser, because before I would always say, yeah, it's great, but Google Chrome is way better at translating languages. Now I can tell you it's here. We've been waiting for forever. At least I have. And now it can be done.
Well, fantastic.
So that is my recommendation.
Excellent.
Yes.
Well,
so
I'm going to go back to Firefox then. I used to be a Firefox person for years and years and years. And then basically once grad school started to want me to research stuff, I had to hop over to Google Chrome.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep. Well, next time I think we're going to do the next king, Al-Mundir, because spoiler alert, it's real short.
Ah, gotcha.
And then we're going to go back up and do Alfonso III in the north. And then we'll check on the counties, Barcelona and Navarre, and see what's going on over there. So that's where we're headed from here.
We have a very follicle person. Coming up, and I'm looking forward to that.
All right. Well, we will see you next time.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.